Welcome to Homeground. I'm Brian Kahn. In our age of wondrous cures for so many illnesses, it comes as something of a surprise to find one without. More so when the malady affects tens of millions of people. And perhaps most amazing is the intense and complex controversy concerning a class of medicines proven widely effective in treatment. The illness, chronic pain. The medicines, opiates and opioids, natural derivatives and man-made imitations made of opium. We have two highly qualified guests to discuss this issue. Dr. Mark Mentel, Associate Program Director, Osteopathic Curriculum, Family Medicine Residency of Western Montana, and Tootie Welker, former Executive Director of Sanders County Coalition for Families, a domestic and sexual violence program, and many years sufferer of intractable chronic pain. Many thanks to you both for joining us on Home Ground. Tootie, where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
Grew up in the Midwest. My dad was a salesman. My mom was a teacher's aide.
Where in the Midwest?
Mostly in Kansas until I left home at 19.
When you left home at 19, what were the central values that you'd learned in that family and that setting?
I would say stoicism.
How about education?
I'm the first in the family to have not only a bachelor but a master's degree. In the University of Florida in Gainesville, finished the master's in 1989.
And the master's was in what?
Rehabilitation counseling.
Tell us, if you could, in summary form, about the shelter that you were executive director of.
It was a very small rural program in western Montana, Sanders County. Started on a $20,000 grant and left 15 years later with a $700,000 budget.
And the period of time we're talking about?
1995 to 2010.
What's your experience with intractable chronic pain?
I've had low back pain since my 20s and started seeing a chiropractor. It became chronic in 2003, and I've had multiple back surgeries since then.
Now, there's pain and there's pain. I want you to describe to me as best you can what we're talking about when it's bad.
When it's bad is that you wake up every morning going, what is it can I do and what is it I have to do today? Some days my day is getting up and feeding the dogs and then climbing onto the couch. Getting up and doing a few things and then climbing back on the couch. It's a very self-limited, it's isolating. It makes it so I can't go out at night with friends, so my only socialization is my daily visits to the dog park.
It sounds like something like that could lead to depression.
Absolutely.
Have you suffered depression?
Absolutely.
Normally, when one has an illness, one goes to a doctor, describes the illness, and the doctor has some medicine to propose. Has that been your experience in dealing with this chronic pain?
It was earlier, before the opioid hysteria, as I call it, came to be. In 2003, when my pain became intermittent and turned chronic, I was able to access appropriate pain medication through the Montana Spine and Pain Center. I was up to 150 milligrams of morphine a day with 4 to 6 hydrocodone.
You were on the medication, opioid medication?
Yep.
It was not hard to get at the time. You said it began that way. It suggests that that's changed?
Yes. And without that, I would not have been able to continue running the nonprofit I did. In 2012, when I had to have the second surgery, it became more difficult to find people willing to prescribe opioids for pain. In 2014, I had my last fusion surgery early, before it was really medically necessary, because I could not find anybody willing to treat the pain.
Dr. Mentel, where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in the Midwest as well, northern Michigan. My parents were small business owners, packaged liquor store, near the Straits of Mackinac, in a very rural area of about, our population of our town was 300 people.
That's fairly rural, even in Montana.
Yes.
So where'd you go to school?
Went to undergraduate at a small Christian college, Methodist college in the southern Michigan called Albion College, and then went to Michigan State Medical School.
Why medicine for you?
Medicine for me was a great way for me to continue with what I think was our family's overriding interest or overriding principles, and that's service and people matter. And I thought medicine was the best way for me to blend my interest of science with applying it to taking care of people.
Those two central values, people and service, mattered. Were they modeled by your parents or just the community you grew up in or intuition?
I would say modeled by my parents. And in the small area of a small rural area, you learn to help one another and you kind of pitch in when neighbors need a little bit of help. So.
And how long have you been a practicing physician in my layman's language post-residency?
22 years, Brian.
And how did you get involved in this issue of pain management? You hold some other title. I did. Your titles were getting long there, so I cut one out. What did I cut out?
I work with the Montana Medical Association in regards to prescription drug abuse, but also looking at ways that we can best manage and help our population in Montana deal with chronic pain.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking about the issue of chronic pain with Dr. Mark Mentel and Tutti Welker. How long have you been involved with this issue of opiates and opioids?
I would estimate approximately 3 to 4 years right now, Brian.
I'm going to read you some statistics and see if we're in the same ballpark as grounding the discussion. This came from the CDC guideline for prescribing opioids for chronic pain, 2016. An estimated 20%, this is quote, an estimated 20% of patients presenting to physician offices with non-cancer pain symptoms or pain-related diagnosis receive an opioid prescription. In 2012, care providers wrote 259 million prescriptions for opioid pain. That seems to me like a big number, both numbers.
That is correct, Brian. As far as a population of the U.S., we make up approximately 4.4% of the world's population, yet we consume 80 to 90% of the world's pharmaceutical supplies of opioid and opiate medications. At the beginning of the century, around late 90s, early 2000, we were writing about a quarter of the amount of opiates we were writing now. Current CDC statistics show that we have essentially tripled and quadrupled the amount of opiate sales. And when you look at overall consensus, how we've addressed pain, we have not made a dent in it. I think everyone's familiar with going to a physician and they're asked, what is your pain level today? Everyone gives a pain score. Over the past 15 years, the CDC has kept track of those pain scores. And even though we prescribe a large majority of opiates, we have not made a dent and addressing pain.
Let me read you another sentence in the same paragraph. Rates of opioid prescribing vary greatly across states in ways that cannot be explained by underlying health status of the population, highlighting the lack of consensus among providers on how to use the medication. Do you agree with that statement?
Definitely agree.
I want to see if I understand your position clearly. What you said sounded like we're using a heck of a lot more of this stuff and it's not accomplishing anything.
Yes and no with that, Brian. What we have is, and I will quote a recent New England Journal of Medicine article by Dr. Alford. Right now, we're in a juxtaposition right now, and I think we're actually repeating history of what happened back in 1914. In 1914, there was the Harrison Tax Act, which taxed opiates, cocaine, marijuana, and other medicinals at that time. With that came increased scrutinization of physicians and legislation against physicians and penalties against physicians where physicians were jailed and even lost their license for prescribing opiates in inappropriate ways. The country went through a phase of not prescribing opiates to the point where cancer patients and even those suffering from acute pain weren't appropriately addressed. We're in that same position right now.
That's an amazing statement to me in the sense that we're talking roughly 100 years later. You're saying that because of a political reaction to medication, which has some addictive qualities.
Correct.
I would imagine it's very hard for you or any other physician to name an area of medicine where they're pretty much in the same place 100 years later. Is that a fair statement?
That is definitely a fair statement.
So that suggests that there are serious non-medical factors involved in this dynamic.
Correct.
Now, Tutti, you used the phrase earlier, opioid hysteria. Is that what you're talking about in essence?
Yes. What I mean by that is that we have lumped all opioid overdoses into one category. We're conflating chronic pain people in with addicts. if you look at the CDC and the different federal registries that talk about overdose deaths, very few are opioids alone. Almost always are benzodiazepines are included in those, alcohol misuse. And yet if you listen to what's being reported in the news, we simply say opioid deaths.
Okay, and you're arguing that that hypes the concern.
It misleads.
Okay. I'm reading now from the Federation of State Medical Boards on the same issue. While recognizing that adequate evidence is currently lacking as to the effectiveness and safety of long-term opioid therapy, this model policy, which is what this is I'm reading from, is designed to promote the public health by encouraging state medical boards to adopt consistent policy regarding the treatment of pain, particularly chronic pain, and to promote patient access to appropriate pain management. Now, that statement in English sounds to me like an effort to say, okay, we got a problem. We don't have definitive answers yet. We need a rational process and standardization.
That is a fair statement, Brian. If I can go back with what Tootie was addressing, Tootie is exactly 100% correct. Right now, our medical providers, those primarily in the front line, such as family doctors, internal medicine doctors, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, we're stuck between an anvil and a hard place. On one hand, society is asking us to curb our use of opioid medications, cut back because of the opioid problems that we have in our country. And on the other hand, we're asked to make sure we take care of pain in an appropriate and ethical way. At the time back, I'm going to go back to 1914. In that time, about 1 in 300 Americans were addicted to opiates at that time. Congress interceded, created increased legislation to restrict the use of opiates. That crisis pales in comparison to where we're at right now. Currently, there's about 1 in 50, 1 in 100 Americans suffer from an opiate addiction.
Are you including in the opiate addiction medicines prescribed by doctors specifically, as opposed to street stuff or stolen prescriptions?
This is just purely those people who are addicted. This is not patients who are in pain.
Okay.
And if you look at the opiate addiction, about two-thirds of that is comprised of pharmaceutical-grade opiates. About a third is on-the-street heroin.
Okay, now here's the question that leads to me. If one takes that number as a combined number, and if one says to oneself, this reflects physician abuse with patients, we're going to crack down on those prescribing physicians, it leads to one set of enforcement policies. If one says that the prescription abuse part of this equation is very small, it leads to a different approach. What's the medical profession saying?
I would like to quote, actually, what Dr. Alford from Boston University, it was in a recent New England Journal of Medicine, and I believe, as well as many physicians, that education has the potential to both reduce overprescribing and ensure that all patients in need retain access to opiates. There is an ethical balance we need to manage and need to think about. If we follow a principle of medical ethics, which is founded on four basic principles, beneficence, non-malfeasance, autonomy, and justice, we should be able to come to that right balancing point of making sure patients have access to opiate medications in a way that they're not viewed as being suspicious for drug seeking or as getting suspicious behavior or stigmatized, as well as addressing those individuals who may be getting into problems with the medications or diverting the medications.
Tootie, what do you have to say to that? That says education is the answer to gradually correcting the problems.
I think there's some of that of education. I think there's a couple points that are important to make. Is that there was a recent study in June that looked at 26 other studies that 3.3% of chronic pain patients actually become addicted to their opioids. So it's a very small percentage of patients who, with chronic pain, who are using their medications appropriately, actually become addicted. Number two, when we talk about overprescribing, one of the pieces that, just like we would not set a set dose for what you can give for insulin. It's an individual amount. And what's happening with people on opioids is there's a particular enzyme, CYP450, on how you metabolize opioids. Some people need larger doses to have the same beneficial effect. And yet if we keep putting out these prescribing limits like the CDC is, it's going to curtail those patients from getting adequate dosage for adequate pain relief. If they say they need more, then they get described as being as a drug seeker.
Mark, what do you say to that?
Well, Tootie is correct. There's a recent study just came from out of North Carolina. We're still trying to learn a lot about opiates and how best to use them within the situation of chronic pain. I would like to think that, you know, as you had mentioned in the Federation of State Medical Boards, there's not great evidence to show their use. However, what we really have is a problem of we don't have enough evidence to show where they may fit. I had quoted that as a general whole, as a population, that they're not working, but I do believe there's probably subsets of the population where these opiate medications can be used appropriately. Getting back to Tootie's statement where 3.3% of individuals become addicted, that is true. Very few patients with chronic pain become addicted. The North Carolina study showed that as you increase the doses of opiates, your risk of death increases, but there's no specific point of saying where that occurs. It's not a curvilinear approach, it's more of a linear approach.
The doctor's pointing out that the statistics are not clear as to the number of patients who are helped by opioids. Are you one of them?
Absolutely. And the WHO has actually what they call an analgesic ladder that they look at in prescribing opioids. And the first thing you would do is stop or look at non-opioid use and alternative practices. The problem there is most insurance does not cover chiropractor, massage, acupuncture, all these alternative other types of treatment. The second step, you would do a low-dose opioid. If that wasn't reducing the pain, then you would go to a higher dose. And then how you decide whether it's working is that patient's functioning increasing? Are the side effects not affecting their life? And if once you find a dose that they are functioning adequately, you keep it on them. Okay. I would not have been able to have written millions of dollars of grants for my nonprofit if I had not had opioid pain relief.
In a nutshell, your experience personally sounds to me like a standard graduated interaction between you and your physician to decide what is an appropriate treatment.
Yes.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking about the issue of chronic pain and opioids with Dr. Mark Mentel and Tootie Welker.
If I could, I'd like to just comment on what Tootie had stated. And again, I'm in complete agreement as well as the Montana Medical Association. She is correct. Our reimbursement system favors the use of medications alone, despite evidence supporting multimodal care such as physical therapy, chiropractic care, neurobehavioral care. We are stuck sometimes in medicine with being forced to just use medicines when really multimodal approach is the best for patients overall. In addition, MMA wrote to the CDC recommending to take away dose limitations on opiate prescribing because the data is not there to suggest that there's one fine point that poses a specific risk. What the evidence does show, as you increase the dose, the risk increases of death, but there's no set limit. And there are people who may be fast metabolizers or metabolize it differently. There's a lot we still need to learn in the realm of chronic pain and chronic pain management.
You say there's a lot to learn, and I frankly appreciate the medical modesty of the statement. In the Federation of State Medical Boards document, there is this paragraph, model policy for the use of opioid analgesics. The FSMB encourages every state medical board to work with the state attorney general to evaluate the state's policy, regulations, laws in an effort to identify any barriers to the effective and appropriate use of opioids to relieve pain. That's a pretty strong statement. While ensuring that adequate safeguards are in place to deter and rapidly detect those who would obtain opioid analgesics for non-medical purposes. So as a layman, it's a statement, look for any barriers, get rid of them, but it's giving two messages to people. What is the status right now of those two messages? Because they go throughout this thing. I would just point out that on a couple of pages later, in detail instructions, this is bold type. These are cautionary notes. Inadequate attention to the initial assessment to determine if opioids are at work. Inadequate monitoring during the use. Inadequate attention to patient education. Unjustified dose escalation without adequate attention. Excessive reliance on opioids. Not making use of available tools for risk mitigation. When I read the bullet points that follow that general statement that says get rid of any barriers, if I were a doctor, I'd say, give me a break. I don't need these headaches. This is putting me at risk. Somebody's looking over my shoulder. How strong is that dynamic in this problem?
It's huge, or as Bernie Sanders would say, huge, which is why California has a Pain Patients Bill of Rights that basically puts a firewall between doctors, the DEA, and medical boards for doctors who are well-trained in treating chronic pain. So there's not somebody looking over their shoulder. We want to get the same thing here in Montana. Recently, the U.S. Senate is also looking at legislation because there's a recognition that we've gone to the point that we're making it even more difficult for people who need access to opioids to get it. But what's really happening, and I've certainly found here in Montana, as you said, Brian, most doctors don't want to deal with this potential oversight, having medical boards, DEA, whatever, looking at them. So they're just deciding to quit prescribing altogether.
Mark, we've just added the United States Senate. So now we have the doctors, the patients with the problem, medical boards and organizations and oversight boards, and now I have the Senate getting involved.
You forgot the president.
I hadn't heard it that he was there, but I'll throw him in the mix. Seriously, that is an unusual mixture, it seems to me, of players. One can have a laudable goal of education, sharing knowledge as quickly and objectively as possible, to improve the quality of care. That's what I understand is the behind this, utilizing those four principles that you articulated.
Correct.
But the actual dynamic of a program often has different results. What's your assessment of what's going on, either in Montana or nationally, with this approach to try to stress education and share information versus, I will generalize, a more politicized, whether it's drug law enforcement or a politicized process?
Well, I'm a basic individual, so I like to go back to basic principles. And what I see is, again, going back, we're repeating history from back in 1914, where you had two opposing positions, physicians and the public. What really I think, on both sides, you have fear. You have fear on the patient side of not having access, which I think is well-founded. You also have fear on the public side of opiates are being prescribed at unheard of amounts than before, creating a public crisis.
What is the crisis? In other words, it says it identifies risks of overuse,
correct,
dependence. If we compare, you know, we're always in policy making comparing,
correct,
risks and opportunity. If you have people who, like Tootie, have what I'm calling acute pain, I'm told that's an improper, you're intractable, severe pain. I want to say this. She said to me on the phone 2 weeks ago, if this situation doesn't change, when my animals die, I will kill myself. Now, when somebody tells you that, and I listened to her voice and the way she said it, I took it seriously. And I deeply appreciate your cooperation in this program. But when I put that sort of statement on the one side and the public's concern about, quote, risks, unspecified, I'd go with the patient. And I'd say I trust the patient and the doctor until proven otherwise. So what's on the other side here?
Well, the part of the education, if I can go back to when we started asking the question, when patients started coming to their offices about addressing pain, what is your pain level today? Mm-hmm. The knee-jerk response at that time, if we're asking the question, there must be an answer. And the answer came in the way of overprescribing of opiates inappropriately. And there also became the idea that these medications were safe. So you would have patients diverting them between family members, friends, and with neighbors. So with that created a crisis of people addicted to opiates. That doesn't include patients who truly may have a benefit from them, but we have two areas that we have both sides fear. The idea is that if we can educate our providers to practice to a certain standard where they're not fearful of prescribing medicines, we also can teach our patients how these medicines may help and how may they hurt, we might reach that nice balancing point where we help those who we can, but don't harm those who might get into harm's way.
You've been practicing 22 years. You know the world you live in politically, medically. What's your projection as the chances of that happening the way you hope it will happen?
I'm hopeful, optimistic, but it's going to take a lot of work on medicine's part.
Mark is saying this is going to take time and is going to depend on a serious effort from the medical community. What's your response?
I don't have time. I'm 59. I'm tired of going into physicians and being treated like an addict, of being, say, that when I'm in tears because I'm in so much pain, that instead I'm exhibiting exaggerated pain behaviors. And so the mentality has become, instead of you being believed as a patient, you're in pain, you're automatically disbelieved, and you have to go out of your way to prove that you're really in pain.
Okay, now, I deeply appreciate what you've said at your personal level. Do you disagree with what Mark says about, given the ambiguities and the history of this and where we are on the learning curve, that a serious educational component of the medical profession, potentially involving the patient community, is necessary? For the millions of others that are in the same situation. Do you agree with him?
Absolutely, which is why there's a pain initiative coming up, and I've been working diligently trying to figure out how they're choosing which chronic pain patients will be on the panel, because I want to be on that panel, and yet I am not being given the information on how to access that.
Mark, what do you have to say to that?
Well, I'm glad Tootie brought that up, because I am the chairman right now for organizing the Montana Pain Initiative this upcoming June.
And you are joking.
I am not joking.
Okay.
However, Tootie does not know it, but after the show, I was planning on asking Tootie if she would participate in the panel discussion, because her voice needs to be heard.
I'm guessing the answer is yes.
It is a very absolutely yes.
Mark and Tootie, I very much regret to say we're out of time, but I'm very pleased with the outcome of this show. Many thanks for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studio. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.